side. To talk with Art Bell, call the wild card line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
I wonder if there really was a way to revive the dead, to reanimate the dead. Would it be ill-advised or something that people would crave? Just one more little taste of life. We'll be right back. Medical science can do a lot of, it can do a lot of really interesting things. For example, the recent story that aired, I don't know, a couple of years ago on 60 Minutes about the lady who had the aneurysm, right? And an aneurysm is like a little filled up balloon in your brain, which was absolutely inoperable, except they came up with a new idea. They cooled this lady down, reduced her body temperature, took all of the blood out of her body, stopped her heart. Brain waves went flat for 40 minutes. 40 minutes. Put the blood back in her body, pre-warmed, I might add, as you would a baby bottle. And thump, started her heart with a little thumping, and this lady came back. Well, back fully intact. And so where in the heck was she for 40 minutes, doctor?
They probably gave her something like phenobarbital to induce a coma.
Mm.
So that brain was, you know what, if you had looked at the brain on an EEG, it may have looked like it was dead because it was in a drug-induced coma.
But not being fed by any blood.
You know, that's what they do when kids are pulled out of cold water and they want to revive them.
Yes.
They give them phenobarb and they put them into a coma. It essentially puts the brain into this state of suspended animation so that it everything else can recover, and then the brain is slowly brought back up again.
If there was a way to revive the dead, perhaps those dead for, you know, various periods of time and frozen, would it be, in your opinion, a very ill-advised thing to do or a scientifically valuable thing to do?
I think it'd be fascinating, but I don't think it would be advisable from the point of view of all of society. And I know we talk about ourselves as individuals, and we think we don't want to die. Of course we don't want to die. We're having a good life.
Right.
But when you look at overall society, and you look at people, you know, and cities and populations, I just have to get back to what is the best thing for all of mankind. And I don't think it's having huge buildings with jars and jars and jars of brains waiting for reanimation.
Hmm. What current technology in the world? I've got my own answer. I wonder what technology scares you the most right now.
That's hard. You know what scares me a little bit is biotechnology. It's because we're fooling around with genes. We're putting genes into things that don't normally carry them, like cow genes into tomatoes.
Yes, we are doing that.
Or, you know, frog genes into vegetables.
Yes.
And so the question is always, what is the consequence of this? And we don't always know that.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about it, why would they put a cow gene in a vegetable? What are they trying to get it to produce milk or something? What?
Maybe they want it to be a beefsteak. I don't know. No, I can't really recall why they were putting meat. It may have had something to do with frost.
Frost.
Frost, yeah. Making them more frost resistant, but I can't recall why they did that. But it led to this sort of odd question for vegetarians: is it safe to eat a tomato now?
With a cow gene.
A cow gene in it, right? I mean, are you being perfectly pure about that? But the other thing that scares me as well is the fact we have all these crops of, you know, genetically engineered crops that are all one, they all have the same genes. So if something happens to wipe them out, we may have lost a big supply of our corn.
Answering honestly, what do you think the oops factor is in this kind of work?
The oops factor, oops, it got out.
Yeah.
It got out, it's now spreading, it's out competing native grasses, for instance. And,
right.
Right.
How big is the oops factor is what I'm asking. In other words, how large a potential is there for a well-intended but nevertheless catastrophic occurrence?
I don't know. I think it could be pretty big if you're talking about letting a plant seed out there that will completely outcompete everything that should be there for genetic variability. You know, you just don't want the whole world to be taken over by one kind of wheat.
Perhaps not.
No.
Also, I've talked to some scientists who have, this will get you, they've begun to hook themselves up to computers. And when I say hook themselves up, I mean go for a main nerve part of the arm, for example, and hook it up to a computer in hopes of interfacing the brain to some degree with a computer. You heard about that?
No, it sounds like something out of Spider-Man, doesn't it?
Except it's true.
What is the point of it?
I'm not exactly... Well, there are those who believe that the future is going to be man's integration with machines, specifically computational devices, for the most part.
I'm just still having trouble figuring out why you would want to hook up a man would want to hook up to a computer.
You're implying a woman would never want that.
I think women would rather not do that.
Yeah, you're right. Men would be more likely to be willing to be hooked up to a machine.
Yeah, and cool new gadget. That's what they would do.
Actually, there are all kinds of applications possible, I suppose. For example, pilots could give commands to aircraft instantly just by thinking them instead of having to move something.
But you know, that's a little bit scary too, because what, you know how many times you think something that you shouldn't be?
Right. Well, I
do. You have to have absolute control of your thoughts that way. And there's something about being able to filter those controls of your thoughts with what your hands are doing.
There was recently also a movie about an implant that was put into the brain, purely science fiction, of course, but the implant basically recorded the major events of that person's lifetime, and then once they died, a memorial was, you know, the chip, of course, removed at autopsy or whatever, and then that was used to make a sort of a memorial for that person. It took the high points of their life, discarding the lower points, and made a kind of memorial video out of it, as it were. They are getting closer to putting chips of various sorts in us, aren't they?
That, you know, it's a cool idea, but do you really want people to know your lower points?
No.
Yes, I mean, then all your secrets would be made available to your loved ones. That would be a disaster, wouldn't it?
Yes. all right.
This brave new world stuff. I have to admit that I haven't really thought about the interface of computers and people. I'm more focused on things like bacteria and the microbiological world, because that's what I think of as having the worst potential to hurt mankind.
Have you started watching Grey's Anatomy on TV yet?
No, I haven't. I don't watch much TV.
It's now. About medical students. I mean, you were once a medical student, and it sort of portrays the torture that they go through at everybody's hands, you know, the residents and the whatever. Is that true? Is it like...
It is. You know,
really?
You know what it is? It's there is a tradition in medicine that you have to prove that you're a man. This goes back to the days when there were very few women who were in medicine.
Right.
It was part of a trial by fire, and the feeling was that if you couldn't stand the heat, that you really shouldn't be a doctor. And that tradition has really not left medicine. And there is a reason for it, because one of the reasons that you stay overnight and watch a patient for 24 hours or whatever, however long you're on call, is that you get to see the progress of an illness. You get to see what happens, you know, to a patient who has this particular disease, and you can see it with your own eyes. And that led to people, you know, being forced to stay in hospitals for their education. What ended up happening, though, was they were finding that people were making too many mistakes. They're tired. And you know, it led to a lawsuit in New York State, actually, of there was a resident who made a mistake on a dose of medication and killed a patient.
Yeah.
And New York State decided to pass a law that limited residents from working more than 80 hours a week. And you think, that's outrageous. But when I was a medical resident, there were weeks when I was working 100 hours a week.
Wow.
And, you know, you don't get much sleep that way.
No, and you would be prone to mistakes, no question about it. And I suppose many times coming to a patient and having to make a decision without your eyes being all the way open and your brain fully functioning after a cup of coffee, huh?
That's right. And the way the schedule works is when you're on call, people don't really know what it means to be on call. You get to the hospital at 7 a.m. You work all day. You work all through that night. And the next morning, you work all day again. That's 36 hours, potentially, of being on your feet, depending on how busy a hospital it is. You can imagine why residents do make mistakes. In terms of, you know, whether or not you're abused, it depends on the personality of the doctor who is your supervisor. They're called attending physicians.
Yes.
And if you're in surgery, there's a good chance they have some pretty prickly personalities. So I think that there's a reason that women, by and large, decide not to go into surgery. It tends to be much more of a male field.
Well, it's you mentioned the personality. Surgeons, really good surgeons especially, seem to develop a very, God, what's the right word for it? Godlike, I don't, maybe you as a doctor could more easily explain what that personality is.
They're gods. it's because when they are in the operating room, they really are in charge, and everything they say goes. And you know what? To a certain extent, they do deserve that respect because of the hours they put in and the years they put in. To be a general surgeon requires 5 years of residency, and to be a neurosurgeon is 8 years. So by the time they get out, they're well into their 30s. They've been working a long time, and they know a lot.
And so then you're saying that attitude is perhaps justified in some cases.
In some cases. But in other cases, they take it a little bit too far. And I think that they can make the surgical intern's life hell. So what you're describing sounds about right to me.
Well, I'm sure it's exaggerated a little bit, but you might check it out sometime. It's pretty fun. I suppose there is a lot of sort of strange humor in medicine, isn't there?
There is. And, you know, when you work in a situation that's sometimes tragic, you have to learn to deal with it. And I can tell you some wild stories. For instance,
sure.
When I was a medical resident in San Francisco, we had a lot of what we would call, I guess you would say, they were undesirable patients. We used to call them gomers.
Gomers.
Gomers, which is short for get out of my emergency room. Or trolls, you know, people you'd find sleeping under bridges, and they'd come in and you'd take care of them and you just want them to leave again. Well, we had one man who just kept coming back for an infected foot, and we didn't know what to do with him. So finally, this residents all got together and chipped in some money and said, told the man, look, we're going to give you an airline ticket to Los Angeles. You get to L.A., you go to the emergency room, and you check in and say, my foot is infected, please admit me. So the man said, sure. And so they got him an airline ticket, put him on the plane, sent him to L.A., and didn't hear anything from him for a long time. And then a couple of weeks later, something came from UCLA house staff, and it was a big envelope. And all it had in there was an X-ray of a hand. Huh? And the hand had its middle finger extended. So that was the response I got from the UCLA house staff. I mean,
he finally told them, huh?
But there are weird stories too from medicine. I mean, you talk about weird things happening. I can tell you about things that made my, you know, the hairs in the back of my neck stand up.
By all means.
I worked in Honolulu. I was a medical resident in Hawaii and worked at a hospital called St. Francis, which was an older hospital. And there was one wing where they just didn't, you know, the nurses just didn't like to walk down there. And they would tell me that it was haunted. that there a patient had died. They didn't know who it was, but patients who were in that room would often wake up and say, there's somebody in here.
Oh.
So the patients would see this ghost.
Yes.
And, you know, I would hear these stories a lot. Maybe it's because people in Hawaii are much more open to ideas that the ghosts exist. Or another case where I had a man...
Well, no, wait a minute. Before we get away from the ghost, why not? I mean, after all, ghosts are said to frequently inhabit the very area that they're last in, and there's lots of last ins in a hospital.
You would expect hospitals to have a lot of ghosts, wouldn't you?
You would. And so quite a few stories are told. Is this a general truth or just that one?
That was the one I remember from that particular hospital, was there was one room that everybody felt was haunted.
Well, why don't you doctors pay attention a little to these stories in, you know, imagining they might be true?
I do pay attention to them because I've always been interested in ghost stories because my mother still believes in ghosts. And I have spent my whole life looking for ghosts. I've never seen one. I've wanted to, but I've never seen one.
And if you did...
It would make me rethink entirely my whole view of the world and of life in general. You're talking to the original skeptic, and even though I am so fascinated by the paranormal, I'm just always looking for proof, and I guess it's one of those things you can't find very
Is it possible to actually go through medical school and all that's required to get to be a doctor and have a religious belief surviving?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It is.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I think there are plenty of doctors who are religious. And part of it has to do with, I guess, a sense of when you watch someone die, and I've done it so many countless times, you always question where they're going. And
yes.
It's hard to believe that somebody who was alive and talking to you didn't go somewhere. You know, you want them to be somewhere, not just have gone into oblivion.
That's right.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a natural human thing to want to believe, I guess.
It is. It is a natural
But it's also a natural thing for medical school to absolutely drum that out of you.
Well, medical school doesn't try to drum that out of you. All they try to do is...
Maybe not specifically.
Well, they tell you that things must be proven. They tell you that drugs, before you can give a medication, that there has to be a drug trial that shows that it's effective and safe. And that is supposed to be, you know, objective evidence. So I think that again, faith is just something that is very private, and it's something you have to believe in yourself, and you may never have proof for it.
But I would think being a doctor and seeing these things around death and hearing of these hauntings and hearing, have you, for example, did you ever get to hear a patient tell a story of after they've come back from, you know, being arrest?
I've only had one come back and say he was very peaceful, that he was not afraid of dying, but that was only one. What I have had, though, is strange cases of where I did feel that ESP was involved. I had a man who was recovering. He was probably, you know, supposed to go home in 2 days, and all of a sudden he arrested, you know, he had a cardiac arrest, and 30 seconds later his family came running in crying. Nobody had called them. They didn't know. They thought their dad was doing fine. They had been shopping at the local shopping mall, and they just looked at each other and said, there's something wrong with dad, and came running in. And I was never able to explain that.
There's a lot of that. I, of course, you know, because we center on this program on these sorts of things, we hear more of it than you would imagine otherwise, but boy, do we hear an awful lot of that. You're right. But that's a function, I guess, of a living human brain, or perhaps not. Perhaps the person sent no such message, just the fact of their passing.
Mm-hmm.
But through what venue was that sent to them? The person who died?
Is it ESP or is it telepathy? I don't know, but the family knew. And, you know, you're talking to a skeptic, and that was one of those things that just made me stop cold and think, what the hell is going on here? So I certainly have had experiences. It hasn't made me less a skeptic, but it has made me wonder about, you know, maybe I'm not entirely correct about my view of life either.
Well, we certainly don't know. How much don't we know about the human brain?
a lot. We don't know, well, we don't know a lot about everything. I heard a quote that I still believe. Any technology that is sufficiently advanced will be indistinguishable from magic.
Exactly. Hold it right there. My guest is Dr. Tess Gerritsen. In the Middle of the Darkness, I'm Art Bell.
Falling in love was the last thing I had on my mind. Holding you is a warmth that I thought I could never find.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And this night, Dr. Tess Gerritsen. She is a physician and author of a lot of very strange books about the darker side of what could happen in the medical world, I guess, that'd be the way to put it, and definitely the dark side in some cases. Every single one of her books, you know the way you get when you like an author, well, you just go plowing through all her books, and all her books are well worth getting, just lining up and reading one after the other. We'll be right back. I wonder what causes a physician normally dedicated to the saving of lives and the doing no harm thing turn to the dark side. Well?
My mother.
Your mom? That's it. No, blame it on mom.
It's absolutely true. I grew up watching horror films. I think I told you this last time. My mother is a Chinese immigrant.
Uh-huh.
Didn't speak much English when I was a kid, but she did understand horror films. So she dragged me to every scary movie there was, and I was a 5-year-old cowering in my theater seat, and I think I grew up, you know, sort of wondering what was under the rocks and what was behind the locked door, and that's sort of what drew me towards all this creepy stuff. That's why I have this file of weird facts.
Well, there are many people like you, of course, because the horror film industry is thriving. But not a lot of them have the medical knowledge to turn it into... I mean, every good horror really has to have some sort of almost basic, you know, premise and fact.
Yes, it does. But the main thing it has to have is it has to make each of us personally afraid. It has to touch a fear that we ourselves have, nightmares about. So really what I write about are my nightmares.
Could there be a bigger one than waking up in a body bag, or worse yet, buried 6 feet under?
I think that's probably one of those that scares us the most, isn't it? Even worse one for me is having something bad happen to my family. And those are the ones that are really powerful. Those are the kinds of nightmares that I wake up, you know, in a cold sweat about.
I note that you have noted that they've got Tyrannosaurus Rex soft tissue, which seems impossible. I mean, they found a dinosaur and it still had soft tissue left on it. Actual viable soft tissue.
Right, amazing. The corpse had been encased in some kind of rock, and when they dug it up, they couldn't fit it onto the helicopter, and so they had to cut the thigh bone, in half to get it onto the helicopter. And when they got it to its destination, one of the archaeologists there noticed that there seemed to be some kind of soft tissue in there, and she took it out and. You could actually see blood vessels. You could see blood cells.
God, that means DNA. But that means DNA.
Well, right? They're hoping they can get DNA. I'm not sure they have yet. But one thing they did say was that there was something about the blood cells that reminded them very much of blood cells from birds.
And well, the dinosaurs are said to be related to birds, right?
They are. It is interesting that they are able to find, you know, that kind of a similarity. And I think that most people do believe nowadays that that's where they evolved from.
You see something in the evolution creationism battle here?
I do. You know, I have to admit that I have a lot of problems with intelligent design, and I know. Art, I'm going to get in trouble because every time I talk about this, I get lots of emails.
I know, but, you know, don't let it worry you. Really, don't let it worry you. It's much better that you just lay out what you really feel and say what you really want to say. And
okay. Well, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but I'm looking at it from just the point of view of somebody who's looking at it logically. And if you are to believe in intelligent design, in other words, you believe that there is some kind of an intelligence that created us, you still have that same problem of who created the designer?
Yes.
Who designed the designer? You still have to go back to that. You know, where did he come from or she come from?
Sure.
So there's that problem. And the other problem is that if this creator is so intelligent, why did he make so many mistakes? Why did we have so many,
There's always an answer to that. The answer that would be given is free will.
Free will, so that's what caused the dinosaurs to die?
Well, if you can think of a rock having a free will. No, well, I don't know that that says anything about that. I mean, free will allows what seem like mistakes. And when you say mistakes, what do you mean?
I mean so many species that have gone extinct, that clearly were created and then were dead ends and died. And the other question that comes up is, why do we have vestigial organs that we don't need? Isn't that kind of strange that we have an appendix that appears to serve no purpose? It's a little bit like an engineer designing a car with a rudder.
Yes, that's a good, very good point. Why, I throw it back on you, why do we have an appendix?
It clearly must have had a function sometime, in the past, but it no longer does. It's for the same reason that an ostrich no longer needs its wings.
Well, is it attached to us?
Yeah. Oh, yes, the appendix.
It has to be cut free, right?
And we cut it out all the time.
So, are there any anatomical hints about where it is, meaning what it might do?
Well. Part of what we think it might have done is it may have had something to do with the lymphatic system. It does seem to have some tissue inside that may have to do with resistance. It may have to do with our defenses.
Oh.
However, nowadays, the appendix really causes more trouble than it's worth. I mean, that's why we end up having so many appendicitis.
Well, has anybody done any studies on people who have had their appendix removed versus those who have not in terms of disease?
No difference.
No difference. So the appendix is good for nothing.
It's good for nothing. It is a vestigial organ that just happens to be there. It's sort of a hanger-on, and there has not been enough evolutionary pressure to get rid of it. And it's for the same reason I was mentioning, you know, flightless birds. They really don't need their wings.
And how many other organs do we have that seem to defy description in terms of function?
In the human body, I'm not aware of anything, you know, as blatant as the appendix, but I can give you some examples. For instance, of we know that birds don't have teeth, right? They don't have teeth.
Right.
And in fact, there's a saying about, you know, as rare as hen's teeth. But it does turn out that birds do have a leftover gene that seems to be there for making teeth. It just is no longer expressed. So that what it tells you is that birds at one time evolved from creatures that once had teeth, in other words, dinosaurs. And they continue to retain the gene even though it's of no use to them. And all of us, all living creatures, have tons of junk DNA. You know, we have lots of DNA, of the function of which we don't know.
I've heard that, and it's called junk DNA. But
it's because it doesn't code for any proteins that we seem to be using.
But maybe it's for continued evolution, or maybe it's evolution that already has been and is no longer required.
That is exactly right.
That would be your guess, the first?
The latter, that these are leftover genes that we just don't use anymore, but there's no pressure to get rid of it.
Huh.
So, you know, why do we have all this excess stuff? I mean, if you were a designer, why would you have excess blueprints? So there are everything that you look at in your DNA, and
well, listen, up at Microsoft, the baskets are trash cans are full of junk code that they've written.
They were dumped out, but we still carry it in our genes. And so I think that for a lot of reasons, there's really no doubt about evolution. I mean, we talk about it being a theory, and that's what we get hit with. Oh, it's just a theory, but the truth is, I mean, what is a theory? I think that people don't understand what it means in the scientific sense, which is it's a logical and well-supported explanation that explains a great variety of facts.
Well, since you've got one foot in the frying pan, let me help you get the other in. Then how do you account for the Bible? Do you think the Bible is just sort of a nice story?
Man wrote the Bible. Whatever the flaws of the men who wrote the Bible, they certainly seem to have believed what they wrote.
What about all the miracles and Jesus? A nice work of fiction?
You know, who knows? They were written by man, and man is flawed, and we don't know whether their recounting is absolutely accurate. And we were talking about corpses reanimating.
There is a
theory that the resurrection of Jesus was actually a case of misdiagnosed death. That he may have been put into the tomb alive, and then he was still alive.
Awfully big coincidence, though. I mean, you don't frequently, you know, predict those things.
No,
fairly
you
rare.
You can't predict them, but we do know that misdiagnosed death has happened again and again through history. So that may in itself may not be a miracle. You know, I think the Bible has, if you take it as a point of philosophy, it has some very fine things to say, and certainly, if you were going to take Jesus' word, he was a powerful philosopher. But taking the next step further, did these miracles actually occur? Is there a designer, a supernatural designer, who created mankind, who created?
Yeah, but the problem is that if some of it is a lie, then it all could be.
Well, I don't think you have to characterize it as a lie. I think you could characterize it as fables that they had heard from previous generations.
Well, I don't know. Seas parting and all that sort of thing, that's pretty clear.
Well, you know, a number of civilizations have the same kind of myth about floods. You know, some people will say it's Atlantis, it's the Atlantis theory.
You probably don't know the name Matthew Alper. But
no.
he wrote a book called The God Part of the Brain, simply saying death is our biggest fear.
Mm-hmm.
The brain, in a defense to that fear, because it always forms a defense, demands something like religion, and that even when you go into the deepest forest in the middle of heaven knows where, you find people worshiping something.
Right. We do have a spirituality part of our brain.
That's right.
Whether it's for Christians or whether it's for people who worship the earth, there is something that wants us to be in touch with something deeper, something very spiritual.
In the Old West, they called them dirt worshippers.
Hmm.
Dirt worshippers. Well, that's not so far off. I mean, that's worship of the earth. That was a slang term for it, but you know, it conveys the message.
But we certainly do have the capacity for worship, whatever form it takes. But it doesn't mean that you can't also believe in science as well, and you can't believe that we carry our past in our DNA, which in a way is just as wondrous a thing. There's so much about nature that's very wondrous.
All right, this is important to me. It really is important to me. I'm scared of the bird flu. I look at various things around the world, and the bird flu thing is actually scaring me. I've read story after story here on the air, which in an eerie way seems to have scientists and biologists predicting, you know, just saying, almost saying, it's going to get ready, it's going to happen, the bird flu's coming.
It's going to happen.
You're saying it too.
I'm convinced it's going to happen. Maybe, who knows when? I mean, it maybe not in 5 years or 10 years or whatever, but we are going to have another flu pandemic. We have them about three times a century. And in fact, you know, the reason I'm actually terrified of this is because I've been doing research on the 1918 pandemic and saw what a truly living horror it was for people back then. And I just got a bulletin from the Harvard School of Public Health.
Oh.
And this is a man, he's a physician, and he says, it's coming. And he points out that the 1918 pandemic killed, I think, probably closer to 50 million people, but it may have been 100 million. And he says, we are totally unprepared. And I didn't realize this, but our Homeland Security Department has actually looked at 12 disaster scenarios, and even Homeland Security agrees that the most likely and probably the most deadly will be a flu pandemic. So are we prepared for it? This country is not.
We're not.
We're not. And compared to other countries, we are in pitiful shape.
How does a country prepare for it?
Well, okay, just take the country of Finland, all right? They have a population of 5 million people. Their government has decided that the pandemic is coming.
Okay.
They have stockpiled about 1.5 million doses of something called Tamiflu, which is an antiviral.
I've heard that's the most effective against it. True?
Well, it seems to have effectiveness against the bird flu, the what they call H5N1 strain of bird flu. So they have enough to take care of, 20% of their population. The English people have enough to protect 25% of their population. They have 15 million doses of Tamiflu that they are going to be stockpiling.
What would the mortality rate likely be then?
Well, the mortality rate, as the first group of people who died of the bird flu in Southeast Asia, the mortality rate was about 60 to 75%.
Wow.
This year it seems to be dropping a little bit. It's now down to about 40%, which means possibly the virus is changing. But just to compare countries, the U.S., what do we have? We are apparently going to be stockpiling enough to take care of 1% of our population.
Doctor, is that what a virus does? In other words, if it, in its evolving way, decides it's too deadly, does it make the trade-off and become somewhat less lethal, spread more easily so that it doesn't kill itself off? Is that what a smart virus does?
A virus doesn't care.
Well, it wants to live, though. Well,
a virus wants to live, and as long as it can find new victims, it doesn't care if it killed the last one. So that, flus, this is the thing, the flu virus is a marvelous example of evolution. It's constantly changing because it constantly wants to jump from one victim to another.
Right.
And it really doesn't even belong in people. It belongs in birds. The flu virus is sort of like, its natural habitat is birds. And it jumps over to us because we have contact with poultry, with chickens and ducks, or it gets into an intermediary such as a pig.
Why in the case of this particular bird flu, do the biologists and scientists seem so sure it's going to happen? Why?
Because it has already infected, 100 people, 75 people in Southeast Asia. It has gone from human-to-human transmission. That's the scary part.
Oh, now you see, I didn't know that. I didn't know that had been confirmed.
Yeah, it has, within families, it has. And one of the cases was so mild that he didn't even know he had it, but apparently he did have the antibodies to it. So it has already gone human-to-human. They are being very careful, and they're watching it. And in Southeast Asia, as well as any chicken farm, there's a lot of contact between people and the avian world. And so there's plenty of time for this virus to jump over. Now, the reason it becomes dangerous, I mean, most of the time, here it is sitting in the chicken. It doesn't bother us. But then it infects a person, and that person is simultaneously infected by, say, a normal flu virus. Well, those two flu viruses can exchange their RNA. They can exchange genes, and in that way become not only very virulent, very, very infectious, they can also take on a form that our immune systems don't even recognize.
All right, hold it right there. Two flu viruses that meet each other, take on each other's characteristics, and come and get us. Yikes. Dr. Tess Gerritsen is my guest. I'm Art Bell, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM, music to the ears for the weird at night. Howdy.
Lonely, no one waiting by your side.